Hello again from Holden Village. Today is June 20th, the year 2000, and today is the 20th. Today in the this morning in the Creekside room, we have Jeannie Olson, and she's continuing with our sacred stories, the care, the core of who we are, a vehicle for healing. So let's join Jeannie in the Creekside room. This is tape OLJ 2000-4.
To give you a little background, my name is Jeannie Olson. We were just discussing my name, and it really is Jeannie. Jeannie Olson, and I am a chaplain at a hospital. Now, I'm going to give you background about me because it's the vehicle that I'm going to use to talk about our topic for today, which is our sacred stories, the core of who we are, a vehicle for healing. Stories can do a lot of things. I didn't have the privilege of going to the Bible study this morning, but I'm assuming the rabbi used stories, and of course that's what the Hebrew scriptures are, but a variety of stories teaching us about God's involvement in our lives. And stories are a lot of things, but today I'm going to narrow in on how stories are vehicles of healing. The telling of the stories and the hearing of the stories. And so that's sort of my focus. So to give you a background on why I'm doing this, I need to tell you how I got into this. I am a chaplain in a 500-bed hospital in Davenport, Iowa. We have two campuses, and I am on one campus, and I have half of that hospital. And the units that I cover is I have neuro and pediatrics and oncology and medical and transitional care. So that's half of the hospital. I share that with another colleague who has the other half, and then we have a part-time priest who covers the Catholic patients. In our campus, we also have clinical pastoral education, and for those of you who are perhaps ministers, you perhaps know what that is, CPE. It's a training program for seminary students and for ministers, or for people who are doing ministry, that can take that in our hospital and learn how to be hospital chaplains, and in the process, learn a whole lot about themselves, their strengths, and so on. We also have in our hospital a befriender program. And that started on our hospital about 34, 35 years ago. I think it's the original Befriender program, and I will explain that to you. And other people have sort of copied our program. It's nothing we copyrighted or have a book about, so we can't prove that that's where it started. But I want to tell you how that got started. About 34 years ago, the Episcopal priest by the name of Chaplain Whitmer was the only hospital chaplain. And some auxilians came to him and said, "We're supposed to take around the cart, and on the cart we sell candy bars and magazines, and we're not supposed to talk to the patients. And these patients want to talk to us, and they stop us, and we're not supposed to do that, but they have stories to tell, and we feel so bad that we have to say, sorry, I have to move along," and they push their cart on. "What can we do about this?" Well, the chaplain had read an article in a magazine about an incident in England in a small village where there had been a lot of suicides. And the community knew that something needed to be done because there were families that were grieving the loss of a loved one, a family member. There were those who were afraid this was going to happen to their children. There was just a lot of fear going on in the village. And what was this all about? So they decided to bring in a lot of counselors. They brought them into a church where they felt that some people who would be skeptical about going to a psychiatrist and so on would come, and they used all these classrooms, and anyone in the village could come and be seen. Well, there were so many people that, you know, they had to wait around for their turn. Well, what do wonderful English people do when there are people waiting? They serve tea and crumpets, of course. So the little ladies from the church would make the tea and have a little tray of crumpets or whatever they are, and bring them a cup of tea and sit down, and the people would start to tell these little ladies why they were there. And by the time they had finished the tea and cookies, you know, 20, 25 minutes later, and their turn hadn't come up, they say, well, thank you very much, I feel much better now, and leave. They say, well, you can't leave, you haven't seen the professionals. Well, I feel much better now. And they leave. Now, right now, I want to say, I am not discounting or discrediting or saying it's not important to have the licensed psychologists and psychiatrists and counselors. We need those folks, and there are folks who need those folks. But there's also times when we don't have to have that degree behind our names to do what needs to be done. So Marlon, having read this article and having the situation with the auxilians, said, I'm going to go to the administration. Well, the administration threw their arms up and went, oh my gosh, we can't help little old ladies running around telling people what to do and giving advice and then doing what they're... You can imagine the red tape and the up in arms that the administrators and the doctors and the nurses went through when they heard about this. And Marlon said, I will train them. I will train them to be listeners only. And so he put together a 28-week training program, which we still have today, which I am now the director of. They come every Tuesday night for an hour and a half for 28 weeks. We start in October, we end in May, which I'm off for Christmas and so on. After the first 10 weeks, they also come to the hospital, choosing one morning a week, or for the people who work, we have one evening a week, where they start to make those calls, and they start to utilize what they've learned in class and take it up on the floor. They're given a list of a unit with the names, ages, and that's about it, and go in and make cold calls on people. We found out that people in hospitals especially need to talk. Why? Because they're in a crisis and they need to talk about what they're going through. You know, the word hospital comes from the word hospitality. But how really full of hospitality is a hospital? They give you this skimpy little gown. They tell you you're going to sleep in that bed. They stick you with an IV, and if you're lucky, it's the first time. They tell you they're going to cut you open and do this, and that hurts, and they're going to give you chemotherapy, and that's going to make you throw up. They wake you up in the middle of the night to ask you how you are. It's really not a very place, a place full of much hospitality. Now, hospitals are there to fix you, and thank God we have them, and I wouldn't want to live in any other age but now. But who's there to find out who you are? Now, doctors are so busy, and God bless them, they see so many patients, as have so much to do. And initially, when they're finding out, you know, who you are and what you need, so there's usually this block of time, and there are a handful of doctors who can take the time every day to sit in a room, but for how long? And the nurses, God love them, they have you been in a hospital where they've had enough nurses? It usually doesn't happen. I mean, they are so busy doing the things they need to do to keep you healthy. The social workers are oftentimes doing discharge planning. Okay, you need to go to a nursing home, we need to get you a hospital bed at your house, how many steps do you have? The dietitians are finding out what you need to eat, etc. Who gets to know the patient? Well, the two groups of people who get to know the patient. Anybody want to guess?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping and one more.
Volunteers.
Yes, and the aides. The aides. The lowest paid on the totem pole, right? But they're the ones who give them their bath. What do you do when you're giving somebody a bath? Start to talk to them, and they start to talk to you. Or the cleaning person who's cleaning the room and picks up your picture and dusts it, and you say, those are my kids. They're 4, 6, and 12, and the story starts. And so the people on the lowest, professionally, in this hierarchy of a hospital, are the ones that get to know the patients best. So that's why, as you said, volunteers, we decided something needs to be done here. So our training, if I were to define it in three words, is listening, caring, presence. Now the one thing that we work on really hard is we are not there to give advice. or fix, or say, have you tried, or you didn't do that, did you, or whatever. It's to be a listening, caring presence. And we focus on the story. Now, obviously, I can't tell you what we do in 28 weeks. And I feel so inadequate to this because I wasn't planning on teaching this up here at Holden. And so I didn't bring any of my overheads and my little comic strips to make you laugh and all the things that I feel so comfortable with. So instead, I'm going to be telling you some stories and just giving you some background, but I wish I had all those. When someone has done their first 10 weeks of training, well, let me go back and say something. I'm not just telling you all of this so that you know about our Befriender program and you think, isn't that neat? I wish we had that in our hospital. I'm telling you this because I hope you will be able to utilize what I'm telling you about story in your own life with people. Here you are in a village. You have come with some people you know, but there's a whole lot of people that you don't know. You come as a guest. You come as a volunteer, short-term, long-term. People are just people who get off this bus with a suitcase, and they're a waitress, another person who takes care of the mail, another person who washes the dishes, until you sit down with them and hear their story. And maybe you kind of look at somebody and you think, I'm sure I wouldn't like that person. But then you happen to sit next to them at dinner, and you start to find out who they are. And all of a sudden, oh, there's a whole story there. And you feel totally differently about it. The other reason I'm telling you this is when we are with our friends and they're telling us our story, or our family members, which is even worse, how easy it is to jump into the mold of giving. I don't know about you, but I think of all the times in my parenting that I'd said, if only I had just shut up and let my kids talk. Because eventually, and the gist of our training program is eventually people figure out what they need to do all by themselves. But some of us think we're so wise, and we don't want this person we love to go through these tragedies, and so we want to help them out of our wisdom and experience. But think of how many times you've wanted advice from anyone. It really doesn't happen very often. So, back to our befrienders. And this is also what we as chaplains do. So they've had this 28 weeks of training, or 10 weeks of training. They go up on the floors. They go to a nurse's station and say, do you have any referrals for me today? And what the people that we're looking for, oh, somebody say, oh, there's a sweet little old lady down the hall. She's fun to talk to. Well, do you have anybody who's angry, who's frustrated, who's lonely, who's non-compliant? And they go, those are the people you want to see? Oh, yes. Those are the people who need to tell their story because they've got something to tell. So they will go to a room and say, you know, hi, I'm Susie, I'm a befriender, or I'm Jeannie, I'm a chaplain, and I was just wondering if you'd like to visit today. People invite you into their room. Or how are you doing? Just came by, was on the spiritual care department, just wanted to know how you're doing. Or just want to know if you'd like to chat. I mean, it's that general. Sometimes I'll walk into a room and after having said that, I'll say, oh, look at all these flowers and cards. You must really be a loved person. And it's an affirmation like that that they jump in to where all these flowers and cards came from. And people tell their stories. Sometimes they'll tell an illness story. Well, I'd like to be any place other than here. Where would you like to be if you weren't here? And they'll go on and tell their story. Or they'll tell a story about why they're here and what illnesses and what they've had. Or they'll say, 5.5 months ago, my spouse died. And I've been having these pains in my abdomen ever since. And we get into a grief story. Or we get into a family story. I say, oh, look at those cards. They look like they may have been drawn by your grandchildren. Oh, yes, that's Christopher. He, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So we get into the family story, which leads us to other stories. Sometimes, especially if it's an older patient, we'll get into life review. 80-year-old gentleman, I'll say, what did you do before you retired? I was a CEO for John Deere. But here he is in a hospital gown, you know, looking like everybody else, but used to be somebody when. And that's part of who they are. One time I was walking by a room and I heard this humming. And I looked in the door and there was this wonderful teeny little black lady and she was humming all these gospel songs. And I said, I just love those songs. And she said, that's what keeps me going, honey. That's what keeps me going. Well, right as I walked in, we were into her spiritual story, her faith journey. Because I just picked up on what was happening. And what a wonderful telling as she was getting near to the end of her life and the joy that she found in her faith. So why do we have people tell stories? Because we know who they are. They aren't just a gallbladder in room 203. And because someone, when they have shared their stories, they have divided it. They have shared it. They have given it, some of it to somebody else. It doesn't seem like such a burden. And because in the sharing of the stories comes healing, sometimes spiritual, sometimes emotional, and I would venture to say, having been a chaplain for 15 years, sometimes even physically. Because someone who is listened to feels better, eats better, tries to sleep better, is more calm, is more willing to work with the staff at getting better. Sometimes a widow will go in and you'll start, she'll start talking, and oh, let me interject here too. When I get to the end of this, and I want you to be thinking about this, I'd like you to think of how the telling of stories or the hearing of stories has been a factor in your life or how you've seen this work. So be thinking of that as I'm doing this because there will be time very much so for that. Maybe I walk in and a widow starts telling me about the spouse that she lost 9 months ago and who she is now, who she doesn't, you know, am I Mrs. John Smith anymore? Or am I Mrs. Smith? Who am I now that? And the more a person talks about what's going on in their lives, the more they figure out who they are. Or if I walk into a cancer patient's room and the person starts talking about, now I've had chemotherapy, and I've had a mastectomy, and, you know, I don't know if I'm going to live to see my children, and now they want me to do this, and I don't know if I want to do that, because it's going to da 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 da, but I can't figure out what I want to do. Do I want to give her advice? No. But as she tells the story and figures out the pieces, sometimes they go, you know, what I need to do is. And they hear themselves answer their own questions about what they need to do. Again, we are never there to fix. I have some people come into befriender training and say, I'm here to take befriender training because I want to make people happy in the hospital. Well, you know, sometimes that happens, but that's not really what we're here for. Have you ever felt really awful and somebody comes in with this bouncing, happy personality and you just want to slap? You know, don't try and do that to me. I'm angry and I want to be angry and I'll be angry as long as I'm angry because I need to do this. So making people happy and fixing things isn't what we do. One of the things we do is, and it's kind of best shown in a diagram, is when we go in, and this is kind of a tool for you to remember too, is we get people to talk about the facts about their story. You know, I'm an AIDS patient, and I got the disease this way, and I, you know, now I'm taking all these medicines, and I have to take them every 3 hours, and I'm a cancer patient, and I've had a mastectomy, and I have 3 children, and, you know, I don't, et cetera, et cetera. We get the facts. Question maybe, you know, how do you feel about that? You know, you got 3 little kids, and this must be so hard to be in the hospital, and your parents are on either coast, and, you know, I bet you're worried about your kids. We get them to talk about their feelings. anger, the frustration, the fear. So we ask a question about feelings that takes them to the next step. The person says to me, or I say to the person, you know, has you ever had a tragedy like this in your family before? Oh yes, my mother had cancer. So then we get to history. We go back and find out history. My mother had cancer. So I decided it wasn't going to happen to me. So I exercise and I take vitamin E and I take antioxidants and I eat right and I sleep right and I do all the things that I'm supposed to do. So I wasn't supposed to get this illness because I've taken care of myself. And I watched my mother die of that. So now we're in the area of history. And then we're going to make a long line. I haven't left enough space here. Didn't plan ahead. But if somebody doesn't come in and interrupt the conversation, which of course happens a lot in the hospital. Oh, I'm here to give you a breathing treatment. But let's say we're actually there for an extended period of time. Without our help, they will come to some solutions about how they feel, what they're going to do. You know, there's that one more experimental treatment. My mother didn't have that option. I'm only 32 years old. I've got these three children. They need me. I guess I better go for it. You know, I didn't know what to do this morning. The doctor's coming in this afternoon. But having talked through the facts, the feeling, the history, they come to their own solution. Of course, that's the ideal visit. Doesn't always happen. But too often, and that's why we do 28 weeks of befriender training, people who want to leapfrog, they tell you the facts, and they want to leapfrog to giving you, oh, we had no marker there, did we? They want to leapfrog to giving solutions. And I know I have a friend like that. She loves me dearly. But when I have a difficulty in life or something's happening, I begin to tell the facts of what I'm moaning about, groaning about, angry about, and she immediately tries to solve all my problems by telling me exactly what I could do. And you know how that makes me feel? Like, am I too dumb to figure this out myself? You know? So that's what we train people not to do. And that's what I have most difficult time doing with my children and my spouse. One of the words that we use is parakaleo. Now, it's a Greek word, and it means walk alongside of people. If somebody is happy, you're happy with them. If they're sad and crying, you're sad with them. If they're angry, you let them be angry. You know the in the Beatitudes, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. In the Greek, what it says is, blessed are they who mourn, for they shall have someone walk alongside of them. Don't you love that? Walk alongside of them. It doesn't say pull them. It doesn't say push them. It doesn't say talk to them. It says walk alongside of them. And that's how people who are mourning, what they need, people who are in grief, to somebody to just be there with them. When they need to go out for lunch, we go out for lunch. When they need to cry, we hand them a tissue and perhaps end up crying with them, rather than saying, shouldn't be crying, you know. Well, let's fix this. So we don't have our own agendas. What I'm amazed at is how people will tell people who are strangers, total strangers, the most intimate stories. And I think one of the reasons they do that is because, first of all, we say we're some spiritual care, perhaps that helps. But we also don't have a history with those people. Aren't there people you protect when you're having, especially I see this in women patients, they protect their husbands, they protect their children. I don't want him to know how scared I am. I don't want him to know I'm dying. So they protect their loved ones, but will share the most intimate with a total stranger. Another thing we do is we try and sit down. What does sitting down next to somebody say? I'm here. I'm not running away. I'm here. I'm going to tell you three stories of how we have kind of used this and then use this as a jumping off place for you to tell some stories. The first story is about, I call him Bud. And Dr. Zaintz, the oncologist, came to me and said, I really need your help on this one. He said, I have this woman who has a terrible case of cancer, and whenever I talk to her, she cries and her husband sits on the other side of the room and laughs. He's going to be absolutely no help to her. I don't know what to do with him, but you take care of him and I'll take care of the wife. He said, come on down to the room, I want you to meet him. I can't believe he laughs. I just can't believe he laughs. He just, I don't know how he can be of help to her. So I walk in the room, and I go to introduce myself. I said to him, I said, hello, I'm Jeannie Olson, the chaplain. And he laughs. And I went, to myself, I went, he's not laughing because he thinks this is funny. He's one of those very few people who, when they're uncomfortable, laughs. And so I let her introduce myself to the wife, and then Dr. Zaintz came in and he talked to the wife about what was going to happen to her. And true enough, he sat on the other side, or stood on the other side of the room, kind of pacing, laughing, but this nervous, uncomfortable laugh. And the doctor told him that she's going to have an operation tomorrow, what was going to happen, and so on. And it wasn't appropriate for me to stay and work with the family at that time. There were things that would need to be done. So I knew what time her surgery was. So I went to the surgical waiting room the next day, and he was in fact sitting there all by himself. And I sat down with him, and I said, I know your wife is in surgery. And I asked him a few questions, and you could tell he didn't want to talk to me. And he kind of answered them, how many children do you have? Are they in town? And what do you do? And, tried to get some conversation, and he kind of laughed and say his answer. And you could tell this wasn't going well. Then I said to him, tell me about your wife. She seems like such a sweet person. Well, he started talking. And he started talking. And he said, I met her when she was 14, and we got married when she was 15. And he said, she was just a kid. She didn't know anything. And I was 21.
I got old.
And he said, she didn't know how to cook, she didn't know how to clean, she didn't know what to do when she had a baby, how to take care of him, didn't know how to change diapers. He said, I had to teach her everything she knew. And he said, we had this wonderful relationship. At this time, I would guess he was maybe 50, 55, and she was somewhere in there. So their children were grown. And he went on to tell me all the things they did together and how much their relationship meant. He said, she's so shy, she's so shy. And he said, and then he looks at me and goes, I don't know why I'm telling you all this, but he didn't stop to ask why. He just, I don't know why I'm telling you all this, and he went on with the story. And then he said, he talked for 5 minutes, but I don't talk to people. And then he just continued on with his story. And all of a sudden, and this is about 45, 50 minutes, an hour later, he said, very quietly, I've always done things for her. I've protected her. And I can't protect her from this. I can't go through this operation for her. I feel so helpless. And then he burst out crying, which he was so embarrassed about. But he just cried and cried and cried. We had many conversations. He would never talk to me if his wife was in the room or if his children were in the room. Never talk to me. But if I'd say, come on down the hall, get you a cup of coffee, then he'd talk to me. She died, and I hate to do funerals. I do anything I can to suggest that they might know somebody who could do their funeral, because I don't like to do funerals. But when he asked me to do her funeral, I knew I had to do it for his sake. So I did his funeral. The funeral. When I was at the visitation, the family was there, and I was trying to gather stories about her besides the ones that I knew from him. So I was trying to get to know. And his son came up to me and said, I know my dad talked to you. And I said, yeah. And he says, no, you don't understand. My dad never, ever talks to anybody. He doesn't talk to us kids. He doesn't talk to his friends. He doesn't talk to anybody. He said, I don't know what he told you, and I don't need to know what he told you. All I know is he has told me that he could not have gotten through this had he not had somebody to talk to. I'm not telling you that to tell you I'm a good chaplain. I'm telling you that to tell you the power of stories. Being in the right place at the right time, giving presence, not giving advice, but being in listening, caring presence was all that man needed. And just to think of the mistake that could have been made by Dr. Zaitz and his whole staff that decided they were writing him off as uncaring and not being able to be supportive of his lovely little wife. At that moment, and when a grandson came up, and a 10-year-old kid came up and basically told me the same thing about his grandpa, that I realized even more the vulnerability, first of all, of people in crisis. And what sacred ground that is when people are in crisis, and how sacred those stories are, and how precious, and how we have to hold them being so precious. And also the power of telling that story and what it means in the healing process. Sometimes a person doesn't even need to understand the story. Now you're going to say, what? Well, we had this wonderful befriender. We give people a chapel service, a kind of 15, 20, 30-minute chapel service, and then we send our befrienders up to make visits, and we go up to make visits. And when they come down, they have to write up their visits, giving us kind of the key points of what happened. Does this person need communion? Did they have a spouse die? Do we need to send a chaplain back up? You know, the things we need to know. Kind of the basics of the story. And then they have to debrief with us chaplains. They cannot leave until they debrief. We believe that for the mental health of our befrienders, they need to unload these stories before they leave. Sometimes they're extremely powerful, so they unload them with us. Well, as he was telling me about the story, he says, when I went up and I met this gentleman, and I knew his name, and he told me to sit down, and I got his name, and I got that he had a very heavy accent. Very heavy accent. It was hard for me to get, you know, what he was telling me, but he said, I gathered he had a couple of children, and I heard the word wife, and then he started telling me about his story, and I heard the word hungry, and I heard the word immigrant, and I heard the word illness, and sick, and he said, but he was talking so fast, and he was just telling me the story, and he was so animated, and he said, I only got a word here and a word there, and finally, after 35 minutes, he got a sigh, and he said, thank you for being such a good man, and such a good friend to come and hear my story. And he reached out to my hand, and he shook my hand, and he said, I knew I was supposed to go. He said, why didn't you hear the story, Jeannie? And I said, just out of curiosity, Harold, how did you keep the story going? He said, just kept looking at him like you told me to do, and now we're going to die. And he said, when the story sounded sad, I looked really sad and shook my head like that. And somebody heard it. But I said, I really praise you and give you all the A's of the class for not having stopped him to repeat and to try and get the details, because it really wasn't important. The healing was the telling. And for my final story, I went up to a floor and I see all of Dr. Katz's AIDS patients. We don't have a lot of them. We have about 300, 400 people maybe in our 350,000 community that have AIDS, and they all see one doctor. He's Jewish and we work really well together. He calls me the God Squad. affectionately, I think. But he believes also that people need spiritual care. And of course, many of our AIDS patients are very marginalized. They've been rejected by the church. They feel ostracized. They have left their spirituality and their faith on some distant shore. Well, I came up on the floor because I saw that Dr. Katz had somebody, and I said, I see you have somebody here by the name of Sam. I'm going to go see him. And the nurses just howled. They started laughing. They said, oh, chaplain, you don't want to see him. And I said, why? And they said, well, he's kicked everybody else out of his room. And the nurse said, I'm taking care of him today, and I'm not taking care of him tomorrow. And somebody else said, I took care of him yesterday, and he is the rudest, most obnoxious, foul-mouthed, angry person I've ever seen, and I'll do anything. I'll take 3 extra patients not to have him. And they said, you're going to go in there, chaplain? Yeah, right. I'm like, well, I've been kicked out of rooms before. It won't be the first time, but, you know, I'm going to give it a try. Well, I walked to the room, and he was, you know, the bedside tables that you put over beds, and he was sitting on the side of the bed, leaning on the bedside table, just waiting for his next prey. I mean, that's the way I felt as I walked in the room, with this scowl on his face, and he had tattoos on his arm, and kind of ruffled hair, and a Harley Davidson t-shirt on. And I walked in, and I looked at him, and I go, hey, do you ride a Harley? And he looked at me. I mean, I wore a suit, nylons, heels. We wouldn't exactly be friends on the street, right? And he said, why, do you ride a Harley? And I went, no, but I have a friend who has a Harley, and it is the most beautiful machine. And he looked at me, and I said, have you ever been to Sturgis, South Dakota, where all the Harley people get together, you know, once a year, and his face just lit up? And he goes, yeah. He said, you've been there? I said, yeah, I was there. I said, what beautiful bikes they have up there. And he goes, really? He said, I've been there. And he started off telling me the story of his going to Sturgis, South Dakota, and all these bikers. Well, he told me about his biking, and he told me about, you know, how he got into it, and he was telling me all this story. And I said, he'd been talking now for 15, 20 minutes. I said, must be really hard, you know, to be in this room when you'd rather be out on your Harley. He'd been telling me the facts. I asked him a feeling question. Must be kind of hard to be in here. Yeah, and then he starts in his anger mode. Why he was so angry about having this illness. Why he was angry about being in this hospital. Why? Then he told me the story of how he got AIDS and this heterosexual relationship with very colorful language, I might add. Then he got back into the history. I said, and somebody asked him something, and he said, I said, have you always been a biker? And it jumped back to the history of his life and his family and so on. And all of a sudden, like 50 minutes into the conversation, he stopped and he said, who are you? And by now I kind of moved myself into a chair, you know, by this time, early into the conversation. I stood up and I walked over and I stuck out my hand and I said, I'm Jeannie Olson, the chaplain. And his face just turned kind of white. And his mouth kind of dropped open and he just stared at me. I think it was running through all the things that he had said in front of me. And I said, I have something very important to tell you. And that's that I'm optional. He looked at me. And I said, I know you don't like to be here. And your illness, you don't have any control over. And to get well, you got to take this medication. And so you don't have much control over that. And you don't like being in this hospital. And you don't like wearing that gown. You don't like eating this food. But you have control over whether I'm in your room. And tomorrow when I come around and peek my head in the room and say, you know, hi, Sam, you want to talk? You can say no and kick me out of your room. He was still totally silent. And he looked at me and said, you can come back tomorrow. I deceived him. I mean, truly, I did. Purposely. But that was the only way that I knew. If I had gone in and said, hi, I'm Jeannie Olson, the chaplain, he said, get the hell out of here. I mean, I know that. But because I had let him tell his story, And now he knew that I knew who he was and I cared about him and I hadn't judged him. He was willing to allow me to be present and we had connected. And I would even say that throughout his illness, he was a little nicer to the staff because he knew that there were people here that truly cared about him. And so when I said, you know, that nurse who gave you that shot isn't trying to hurt you, I know, he'd say, she's trying to make me better. And so even in the atmosphere of his room, his telling of the story helped other staff. Now, when I would get into my own agenda, which as a Martha in the Bible, I'm a Martha, I like to fix things. So it's been really hard for me to learn how to be a chaplain and not fix things. So sometimes in my relationship with him, because when I saw how he treated his mother and father, and I knew he was going to die because he was on that path, I'd say, you know, would you like to write your mom a letter that we could just kind of put away till later? You go, no. So whenever I would go in with my own agenda in trying to fix things or make things better for his parents, who I knew were suffering through this too because he was such a jerk, it didn't work. But one day when I was sitting next to him, and he never really spoke honestly with me either, if there was anybody else in the room, because was he going to let anybody else know this kind of other side of him? Oh no, he was a biker. One day he was laying in his bed and he had lost a lot of his capabilities. And at the end of the room, it used to be a Catholic hospital, it became Catholics redid it, and instead of having crucifixes of the crucified Jesus, they got what they call a Lutheran cross, so there's a cross, and then there's a Jesus with a victory sign, resurrected Jesus on the front of the cross. And he looked at me, and he looked at the end of his bed, and he goes, I know who that is. I know who that man is. Now, I knew if I did any preaching or anything, I wouldn't make it. It wouldn't go. So I said, "You do? How do you know him?" And he said, "As a little kid, I went to Sunday school." I said, "So when I'm having a tough time, I just look at him." And I said, "Sam, he loves you very much, and that's good that you turn to him." Those are the only spiritual words we ever shared. But he knew what he could do with his connectedness and his spirituality. Unfortunately, he died before I had hoped more would happen in that area, but it didn't. We are our stories. You know that. Cheryl, do you mind if I tell the story about your doctor?
Feel free.
It's okay?
Mm-hmm.
Cheryl was teaching a great class yesterday, and I recommend her classes highly. They really kind of dovetail. She was working on finding out what was wrong with her, and she went to one doctor who told her it would take 6 months and $10,000. She went to another doctor, and I hope I'm interpreting this right. You tell me if I'm wrong. And I wrote this down kind of when I came back after her class yesterday. She said, "My doctor sat down with me." This is the second doctor. "My doctor sat down with me and heard my whole story, illness, medical, and personal story. And after that, and a physical, he could tell me what I probably had." Is that pretty correct? The thing, of course, I picked up on, knowing I was putting this class together, is my doctor heard my whole personal story. And her story relates to her illness and how important that is in her physical healing to have had that story put together with her diagnosis.